Hello. Now then, I'd like you to listen to a couple of sounds.
It was a complete creation of his own making.
I was the very, very first in the whole world.
I've got plenty of other people. I've got four sisters and two brothers. They've all got plenty of kids. I've got plenty of kids on Jim Will Fix It. So my kids, to me anyway, the best sorts of kids, is they all go home to their parents.
To do things for him, he wants me to fondle him. He asked me for oral sex.
We gave him every instrument that he needed in Broughton to prey on some extremely damaged individuals.
Sir James Savile, OBE, the man who has single-handedly raised more than £30 million for charity.
Why have you said in interviews that you don't have emotions?
Because it's easier. The truth is, I'm very good at masking them.
I'm a rare breed insofar as I'm a single fella, and which is why when people say, them five places you've got to live in, aren't they expensive? And I say, not as expensive as a wife.
Now, the Metropolitan Police say that it will now take the lead in investigating sex abuse allegations against the late Sir Jimmy Savile as more women come forward claiming to have been assaulted by the television presenter.
Who's your best pal, Tony?
Oh, no, Desmond.
He's not.
He is.
No, he's not.
Yeah, that's me.
Because he's a married man.
Okay.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Well, no.
I'm just squashing.
Not until you say me.
Now, me, when I stand in front of the table and St. Peter's there, he says, you are not coming in. And I'll say, well, why not? And he'll say, because you're a villain. And he'll show me the debit side. And I'll say, hang about. And I'll show him the credit side. And he'll say, does that mean anything? And if he says, that means nothing, then I'll threaten to break his fingers.
What does she do with the cable, boys?
And I didn't want to. And he promised me that if I gave him oral sex, that he would arrange for me and my friends to go to Television Central and be on his television show.
Hey, hey, hey! We've got it all happening tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody's around. We're going to start with our guests.
Hope it's been a very good week for you. And here's a very good set to fix it for you. Here we go now with a letter from Leeds. Yeah, Leeds.
Me?
So, I promise.
I promise.
That you... Jimmy Savile.
Jimmy Savile.
Are the only one.
Are the only one.
In my life.
I was 14. Of course I wanted to go to Television Centre. I didn't want to give him more facts. I thought it was disgusting, but I did that. Gary Glitter was one example. He was particularly horrible and only interested in getting as much sex as he could possibly get from any girl.
I'd start with manipulative, then controlling, and very, very clever.
It has become a great British institution. Not bad for just another zany DJ, but there's a lot more to cigar-smoking Jimmy than meets the eye.
I can remember seeing him having sex with one of the girls from Duncroft in Jimmy Savile's dressing room.
I was the very, very first in the whole world to run a dance to record.
You used to be a wrestler, didn't you?
I still am.
Are you?
I'm feared in every girls' school in this country.
Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Todd, and I'd like to thank you once again for joining me as we prepare to take a look at Jimmy Savile. Part 4 of The Life and Crimes of Jimmy Savile. Before we get into it, a couple of news and notes. If you like the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. If you would like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, MeWe, and YouTube. Just look for Ian Totten Author or search for The Deathcast. There is a page dedicated to The Deathcast on Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter at Corpse Creek. If you would like to sign up for the mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com and click sign up. While you're there, please consider making a donation to the show. Buy me a cup of coffee. There's a donate button on there. Just click on it. It is greatly appreciated. Something new, if you would like to become a patron of the show, get your name shouted out, get access to exclusive content, you can now do so. Just go to patreon.podbeam.com/deathcast. There are two tiers up there. There's a $2 tier and there is a $5 tier. Both of them come with exclusive perks, and it is specifically to help offset the cost of doing this show, because most people don't realize it costs money to put the show up onto a platform and then have it distributed to all the various podcast networks such as Apple, iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, Podcast Addict, all of that stuff, as well as to keep the archives up on the Podbean app. It costs money every month to do that, so I'm trying to generate some revenue in order to help offset the cost of the show. Lastly, I would like to thank Private Investigator Ed Opperman for having me on the show this week. It was heard on both terrestrial radio, but you can also find it on your favorite podcast app. It's just called The Opperman Report, where you can search out Ian Totten on Jimmy Savile. And real quick, because my appearance on there has blown things up, to all of the detractors who are laughing about the way that I pronounce Seville's name, suck my motherfucking dick, you cock-sucking troll motherfuckers. Talking to you specifically, Andrew Gillis and Joseph Johnson, you can both blow me. Your internet trolls who like to hide out fucking online behind various accounts and show people how knowledgeable you are. I've been studying this motherfucker for 9 years. You guys listen to a couple of podcasts and think you know everything. Go fuck yourselves. I don't need your freaking listenership, and I really don't fucking care what you say. So you can stop messaging me and commenting on videos. For those of you who have found me via Ed Opperman and enjoy what I do, thank you so much for jumping on board. I really appreciate you guys. Now that that's out of the way and those cocksuckers can go fuck off, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, sit back, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we last left Jimmy Savile, he was really riding high. He had been hired by the BBC to present Top of the Pops. His radio shows were doing exceptionally well, and if I believe off the top of my head, he had left the Mecca dance halls just because he was earning so much money through the BBC and his various radio programs that he really didn't have any more time to spare to take care of the dance halls. He had also interred his mother, the Duchess Agnes Savile, at an apartment, which he had purchased for her. We also discussed his links to various recording artists. The two most notable individual groups that he was associated with in this period of time were the Beatles, who he, in fact, introduced at Wembley Stadium, and the Rolling Stones. That's one of the parts of their early history that is really glossed over. When he was working for the Decca radio programs on Radio Luxembourg, Savile was really their only champion. He pushed their music heavily onto the owners of the station. And it was in large part because of this that the Stones got their first number one hit and went on to subsequent fame. I'm not saying that Jimmy Savile alone was responsible for the Rolling Stones' meteoric rise through the charts and, you know, the legacy that they have, but he did play a significant part in it, because up until that point, the Stones were looked at differently from the Beatles, because the Stones didn't have the same kind of look or aura that the Beatles did. They were a little bit grungier looking, a little more rough around the edges, and radio stations were very reluctant to play their music. But not just radio stations.
clubs were reluctant to play their, let them play there. Seville went on to recount many, many years later how he actually witnessed many riots taking place at Rolling Stones gigs when they first began to become a, you know, national act. And it was things like this, as well as the womanizing, that led venues to be reluctant to book them, and Seville championing them on his radio station as well as on Top of the Pops and every other avenue he had really opened a lot of doors for them that otherwise may have taken them much longer to get through. Seville liked to recount one story concerning the Rolling Stones. This was back when he was still running the Mecca dance halls, where he was able to secure them a spot playing, and the Stones refused to go on because their instruments had been lost. And as Seville put it, he basically told them that they had until the revolving stage that had been set up completed its revolution to make up their minds as to whether or not they were going to take the instruments that were on hand and go out or play, or he would allow his bodyguards to have their way with them before he would throw them to the crowd. According to Seville, or as the internet trolls like to correct me, Saville, the only man who tried to call his bluff was the drummer Charlie Watts, but eventually the Stones ended up taking the stage. In April of 1964, Jimmy went overseas once again, back to America, where he met up with Elvis Presley again. There are some stories out there, and I actually discussed it on the Opperman Report, that he and Elvis seemed to form a bond over their mutual interests, which were making money with the music industry and enjoying the company of the growing throngs of young women who would throw themselves at them. Seville was reported to be making around $40,000 a year, while also raising at least an estimated $46,000 a year for charity. This was through bike rides and runs and some type of situation where he would run up and down steps repeatedly in order to raise money for charity. According to Seville, he quote-unquote, "I came to a crossroads. I found I was making enough money out of 1 or 2 days of work to live like a millionaire. What do you do in this situation? Do you turn into a money grabber, or do you see if there is anybody to be helped along the way? I chose the latter path." The reality is that Seville was a money grabber. He would pretty much do anything that would get him A, paid, and B, publicity. While at the same time, he was out there raising money for various charities and really sculpting the public image that was out there of him. He did this through his various television appearances, as well as his newspaper columns, which is where a lot of the information that is out there concerning his exploits comes from. Seville did give a lot of interviews throughout the years on television, but back at this point in his career, the way he really talked to people was through his newspaper columns, where he would regale his readers with various stories of his sexcapades, as well as, you know, roughing people up in clubs for the way they were acting. Right around this time period is also when the first really serious allegation about Jimmy Seville comes up. And I'm taking this directly from Dan Davies' seminal work on Seville, In Plain Sight, strictly for the reason that he has the most concise timeline of Jimmy Seville available. I have so many of the reports that came out about Seville after the fact, but this really gives you an idea of who this man was. He had met a young woman who was 16 years old in 1964. She had come on to one of his Radio Luxembourg programs in order to promote her Elvis Presley fan club. Seville, who was about to go to the United States for his second visit with Elvis, asked the girl if he had a picture of, or she had a picture of herself that he could bring to Elvis, which the girl gave to him. Not long after returning from the United States, Seville, who was in London at the time, contacted her and told her that he had a gift for her from Elvis himself. The girl, remember, she's 16 years old, went to the hotel room that Seville was at which point Seville forcibly raped this young woman. And to quote her, "I couldn't stop him. I was telling him it hurt. I was holding my body so tight to try to stop him, but he was so heavy, he was so strong. Afterwards, he said to me, 'You're all right now,' as if he'd done me a favor." After this happened, Seville got dressed and gave the young woman some buttons from the film that Presley had been working on in the States, Kissing Cousins. Now, according to this young woman, not long after this, she missed two of her periods and realized that she was pregnant from Jimmy Seville. Apparently, her parents were obviously distraught, and her father quickly figured out that Jimmy Seville was the culprit, because as she stated, Seville called the house a number of times, and when confronted with the fact that he impregnated their daughter, Seville is said to have stated, "It's not possible," after which he hung up and the family never heard from him again. Now, this young woman ended up having to go to a back alley abortionist to have an abortion performed, which was done with no painkillers. And as a consequence of this, the young woman ended up having miscarriages during her early 20s. So there are stories such as this around. Stories like this, I do believe, because there is enough details that can be backed up and verified that it is, you can prove these things happened. Another interesting thing that came out right after this woman came forward came from the Metropolitan Police, who had discovered an intelligence record concerning a house on Battersea Bridge Road. This house was known to have been a place where runaways from Duncroft Approved School for Girls, which was sort of like a juvenile detention center for very bright girls, although it wasn't really a detention center. Girls who had what at the time was described as a troubled upbringing, you know, girls who might be sexually promiscuous or might get in trouble for stealing, that kind of stuff. They were sent to this school, but only if they were of above average intelligence. And the girls who ran away from the school were known to go to this house. And apparently at this house, there were two black men who would pimp them out to, you know, their growing list of clientele. And according to this intelligence report from the Metropolitan Police, Jimmy Seville was known to be a frequenter of this house and the girls who were at it at the time. Now, this is important. As I stated, I don't know if it was in this series or when I was covering the Yorkshire Ripper, Seville was known throughout his career to frequent prostitutes fairly often. And that's one of the places where it's kind of difficult to figure out whether his stories of his various conquests are really blown up versions of his, you know, escapades with prostitutes, or they in fact happened with willing participants that he met through his various jobs. My personal belief is that Seville was so sexually driven that he would frequent the prostitutes when a young woman was not available who might be willing or unwilling to his advances. And you do see this a lot with individuals who are, you know, sexual predators, whether they be sexual sadists or serial rapists. They have such strong sex drives that the commission of their crimes aren't enough to sate their appetites. They will actually go out and pay women for sex in order to keep the beast at bay, as it were. And Seville really does come across as that type of individual where he has so many willing participants in his exploits, but his libido is so malformed and out of control, they aren't enough to sate him, and he has to go out and procure other individuals for his various desires. And as I stated a moment ago, you know, this kind of stuff was known to police, but it was probably because he was starting to become something of a national star. Nothing was done, so far as we can tell, concerning it. He may have been talked to the police under caution, which is, you know, basically the police coming to you and say, hey, we have this information on you. Would you like to tell us your side of the story? If that's the case, it's more likely than not that Seville would let the individuals interviewing him know, hey, yeah, this is what was going on. By the way, I'm really good friends with your police captain. This is, you know, when I was talking last week, the week before, about Seville building up these walls of protection around him, this is the type of stuff he had these walls of protection in place to keep from getting on him. He would go out and do these things, cops would come and talk to him, and as soon as they found out, you know, oh, you're friends with Lord Mountbatten? Never mind. They're not going to stir the pot with that, considering, you know, that they're a quote-unquote lowly police officer, and it's obvious this individual is important because of who he's friends with. At that point, you know, we can't proceed with the charges or the investigation, hands off on this individual. One account that was given to Davies came from a man by the name of Stephen Hayes, who was working for the Manchester Police Department in the early to mid-1960s, who basically went on to recount how a lot of officers would flock to Seville, whether they were on duty or not. And the reason that they did this was that they knew a good time could always be found around him. Now, Hayes stated that they never really believed that he was doing anything wrong with the young women that were hanging around Seville. That he figured most of them were between 18 to 20 years old, and that they would go around him because they knew that they could, you know, for lack of better terminology, get laid with Seville being there. In fact, Hayes claimed, quote unquote, "We used to tag on for the girly element." The one bit of interesting information from the things Hayes said comes from the fact that apparently one of these individual officers who was part of this revolving door in and out of Jimmy Seville's apartment would bring along weed with him that they had confiscated from, you know, supposed criminals, so that he and Seville could get high with the girls before taking, you know, advantage of them. Seville also worked on cultivating relationships with reporters during his lifetime, and this started as far back as the 50s. The reason for this was twofold. He could help control the narrative that was printed about him in the newspapers, but he could also find out beforehand if the papers got a hold of any salacious stories concerning him, whether it be about sex with women or, you know, the ties he had to the underworld, and in effect, he could squash them before they had a chance to make it to print. Seville was known to be a very litigious individual, especially once he began really making money. There are numerous stories out there about him from over the years where he would either threaten to or actually, you know, bring lawsuits against people who attempted to besmirch his name. And it became so well known that he had no problem getting lawyers involved that almost any time a story concerning Jimmy Seville and anything unsavory was brought to a newspaper, they would immediately either contact Seville or contact his lawyers to run it by them, because they knew that he would be on them like bloodhounds should they go to print with it. We get back to talking about Jimmy Seville and his interaction with reporters in just a moment.
Selling author of The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, and The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, comes Maggie, a book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie. The name was burned into Lieutenant Carl Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
All right, we are back. One interesting story that has come out about Seville after his death concerns one of these reporters that he had befriended in the mid-1960s. This reporter went on to state that Seville had actually had sex in front of him in his apartment as though the other individual wasn't there, and that afterwards Seville actually walked into the kitchen, at which point he began to wash his genitals in front of the reporter. A couple people have stated that this action shows the detached, almost mechanical way that Jimmy Seville viewed the act of sex, and I couldn't agree more with that. To Seville, having sex, there was no emotion involved in it. It was simply a means to get what he wanted from the other person, which was control to release his sexual urges and move on. there are a number of stories out there that Seville fathered various bastard children during the 1960s and 70s. In fact, there is one out there, a woman who came forward, who stated that she fears she is Jimmy Seville's child. Now, Seville always denied ever having fathered any children. In fact, he used to joke about the fact that nobody could ever turn around and say he had impregnated the young woman he had been with. Whether or not these particular claims are true remains to be seen, as the last time I looked into it, none of these women who came forward stating they had been sired by Seville have been able to prove the veracity of their claims beyond just making the statement that he had either raped their mother or, you know, had straight sex with their mother. So it is an interesting avenue, and one that I am curious to see whether or not they are actually ever pursued. Seville did state numerous times that it was impossible for him to have fathered children, so it might be that he had gone out and had a vasectomy, although my gut instinct when it comes to Jimmy Seville on this particular matter is he probably, more likely than not, did not have a vasectomy, but in his own warped mind just feel that he was incapable of fathering a child. It's really interesting, though, to look at Seville during this period of time, because you can start to see, you know, with the various reports that have come out, the way that Seville would gain these girls' trust, as well as gain the trust of their parents. He would go around, he would insist on meeting the girls' parents. If their mom and dad were both in the picture, he would meet them. He would come to the house and charm the family. And eventually, he would move on to having a intimate relationship with the girl. And he didn't do this with every girl that he encountered. In fact, a lot of them, it seems that he simply, you know, got them into a place where nobody else was around, at which point he either pressured them into having sex by dangling a carrot over their head, such as, hey, if you do this for me, I will bring you to a Top of the Pops taping, or outright forcing himself on the girls. A number of women, especially from the Duncroft approved school for girls, have come forward, one of which was in an aborted Newsnight program by the BBC, and stated that he was known to show up in his Rolls Royce and offer the girls to take drives, and many of the girls did go with him. While they knew what was going to happen, usually Seville would demand that the girls give him oral sex. They looked at it as a fair, if not disgusting, trade, because Seville would demand these things from them, while at the same time he would bring them records and cigarettes, as well as arrange for them all to come to tapings of his various television shows. These are indisputable facts, things that he actually did do and is known to have done. So many people have come forward and, unbeknownst to one another, laid out claims of really the exact same story, whether it be, you know, the girls at Duncroft proved school, or women who became what Seville referred to as his teams, which I've discussed, where he would have various groups of women and young girls and hangers-on in different cities who he charmed his way into their lives, only to move forward once the parents were sated that he was a good guy that they should let their daughters hang around, and then he would take advantage of them. This is what is known as grooming, and a lot of individuals, whether they are preying on underage children or adults, they go through this, buying them things, treating them nicely, letting them know how special they are, making a big deal out of them. Seville is known to have done this with both children and adults throughout his life. this period of time, the mid to late 60s, is when we really start seeing Seville exhibit this kind of behavior where he's grooming these young women who are to become part of his teams. But it's also where we really start to see him explode in the self-promotion business. Seville had always been good at self-promotion from his beginnings back in the dance hall days, but it went further than that. He would walk long distances, to win $100 bet and make certain that the newspapers knew about it. He would wrestle in professional matches all over the United Kingdom, which obviously would be carried in the local newspapers. And all of this was designed with the sole purpose of promoting the one thing that mattered most to him, which was Jimmy Seville. But he went further than that. Seville also, in the late mid to late 1960s, began his association with the Royal Marines, going on endurance exercises with them. Seville was so focused on proving his physical prowess, which I have to believe comes from being a sickly child and the reality of the accident he suffered down in the mines, that he ended up becoming an honorary Green Beret, and he did this by completing every single course that the Marines offered. And this was something that Seville took great pride in, so much so that when he was buried, his Green Beret was actually in the coffin with him. Intermixed with all of this, Seville began really pushing, you know, his ideology of what teenagers should and shouldn't be doing. In his newspaper reports, he stated that, you know, a lot of teenagers should go out and start walking for charity. They should be forced to do charity work inside of hospitals and that type of thing. See, and you've got Jimmy Seville, who's surrounded almost round the clock by young adults and teenagers, taking advantage of these individuals for his own sexual desires. On the other hand, you have him publicly telling people that, you know, this is how teens should be living, while regaling them, these same individuals, with exploits of his sexual escapades. But there's another side to Jimmy Seville that is often overlooked, and that is Seville's Roman Catholic upbringing. He was raised in a very strict Catholic household, and he would often talk both publicly and privately about his belief in Jesus and in God, and how he looked at the things he had done in his life, and the charity was really a way to balance the books. As he put it, although he never specified why he needed to balance the books, sometimes he said it was because of how many lovers he had, others because of the way he had handled certain situations with violence back in his club days. Many people now believe that Seville, when he talked about this, was specifically talking about the abuse that he was is known to have heaped upon the, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-old female population of Great Britain. Personally, I think he was more of a publicity stunt. I don't believe Seville really believed in the teachings of the church. I think he used that more as a way to legitimize himself. And by that I mean, Seville would put in anecdotes how he had, you know, was called on to speak to both priests and nuns concerning the young people of Great Britain. And later on, as he progressed throughout his career, he would go on to talk about, you know, how he was called to talk to cardinals, about various aspects of, you know, religious life and how it could be applied to, you know, young people, and how the church could convince the young people that they needed to do more for charities and things like that. And I really think it's because Seville needed to legitimize himself, because he knew the things that he were doing were morally reprehensible. But he didn't want that stuff to come out. He wanted this public image of him to be, you know, a little bit edgy, but at the same time, safe. You know, and what is, you know, more safe to, you know, the mind of the masses than a man who cares about the sick and needy and looks out for other people and is rooted in a firm religious belief so much so that the heads of the religion he is involved with actually seek him out to come and talk to them on a given topic. It's really during this period of time when his star is really starting to emerge that he starts adding this extra layer on himself as not only his public persona, but it's another layer of protection, because who's going to turn around and say this guy molested me or he raped me when he's got all these small-time politicians and Lord Mountbatten and various royals, as well as police officers, you know, built up around him. But he's also got, you know, the Catholic Church expounding how wonderful an individual he is. He's building this really suit of armor around himself that is going to become impenetrable to any amount of scrutiny. So it's very, you know, skilled and crafty the way he did this. It's much like the way that individuals, even in today's age, build up this air of, you know, respectability around them and invulnerability, even while they're doing things that are absolutely awful. A good example of that is Weinstein, who was, you know, he was seen as this larger-than-life film producer. He could do no wrong. He was really untouchable. Until he wasn't untouchable. The difference between Weinstein and Jimmy Savile, however, is that Savile actually had power. You know, he had the right people in his pocket. He was friends with the right people. And eventually, as you're going to see we progress, he's got enough power around him that he could really destroy people's lives if he wanted to. Whereas Harvey Weinstein could only destroy someone's professional life. You know, you're not going to get booked in any more films unless you let me do this, that kind of thing. Seville could really, you know, destroy people's lives by having his various friends in law enforcement and the Secret Service and all that type of stuff come and go look into you. Now, one story has come out after Seville's death concerning one of his nephews, an individual by the name of Marsden. Marsden was raised by Seville's older sister. He was one of 14 children. Marsden recounted a story, and he's done this numerous times in the media, mind you, only after the allegations against Jimmy Savile happened. He never did this while it was going on. In fact, he was in the news right after Savile died, talking about how wonderful and great an uncle he was. Marsden talked about how he had run away a number of times, and how at one point he and a group of three friends ran away to London, where they went to Euston Station, which apparently was a pickup area for gay men in the 1960s, 1970s, mind you. This story supposedly takes place in 1967. According to Marsden, they were at this train station when a man approached them and asked them what they were doing. The man offered to buy them food and clothing before inviting them back to his flat, where they stayed for 3 or 4 days. Now, this particular story, to me, reeks of absolute bullshit, and here is the reason why it reeks of absolute bullshit to me. Marsden has told a couple of different versions of this story, and in each of them, his uncle Jimmy Savile ends up appearing. However, one story he tells is that they were at this man's apartment for a few days when his uncle just suddenly appears and takes them out of there before putting them up into an apartment. The other version of this story that Marsden likes to tell is that the man whose apartment that they were initially staying at began dragging them out to parties, and that the four young teens would be sitting at these parties and wondering what was going on and why they were the only boys of their age there. There were never any women at these parties. It was always older men and young children, specifically boys. In the first version of the story that Marsden likes to come out and tell, he states that after his uncle put him and his friends into this apartment, he began dragging them to parties where only men were on scene, along with a number of underage boys. Now, my contention with this story is twofold. A, either your uncle met you at this guy's flat and took you out of there and then started taking you to these parties, or B, your uncle walked into a party, saw you, walked back out, and then came back in all nonchalant and took you out of there before putting in into an apartment, at which point you continued going to these various parties. B, historically, sex offenders very rarely switch genders. This isn't hyperbole. This is fact. It's documented. You can look in the FBI's online records and information on pedophiles. They very, very seldom go from 16, 17-year-old girls to 9-year-old boys, or from 8-year-old girls to 15-year-old boys. A perfect example of this would be the disgraced British MP Cyril Smith. Cyril Smith is known and is documented to have abused hundreds, if not thousands, of young boys. There are no stories out there of him turning around and in the midst of all of this debauchery going and raping a 14-year-old girl. If you go back and listen to my story on Sidney Cook, Hissing Sid and the Dirty Dozen, they targeted specifically one gender, boys. They did not turn around and start abusing girls. So the idea that Jimmy Savile, who is known to had an extremely out-of-whack libido, had girls throwing themselves at him while he's also paying female prostitutes and turning around and raping young women. And in the midst of all of this, he starts raping boys is abso-fucking-lutely bullshit. And there are people out there going to say, well, there's pictures of him at the Jersey Home for Boys. There's a picture out there, possibly two. However, there is no historical record of Jimmy Savile ever having committed any offenses at that home. Savile went wherever there was a chance for publicity, whether boys or girls were involved. And if you look into the accounts of his abuse, the accounts of his abuse take place, by and large, either in a camper van, at a hospital, inside his apartment, or inside his dressing room for Top of the Pops or his other various television shows. The majority of the time when these assaults take place, it's Savile, the woman he is assaulting, or the young girl as the case may be, and possibly a friend of this individual. On occasion, you get verifiable accounts of him assaulting someone inside his dressing room where other individuals were involved, be they rock stars or some of his other various hanger-ons. The majority of the stories concerning Seville and his abuse of boys are much different. There are accounts of him raping young boys, 7-8-year-old boys, in crowded rooms, in hallways, filled with people. I'm not talking one or two people being present when this assault occurs. I'm talking upwards of 20 to 30 other people. And I do not find them to be believable in any way, shape, or form. Again, because of, as I've already stated, historically speaking, and this doesn't hold true for every sexual predator out there, but the vast majority of them have an age range and a gender. Seville's age range seems to be from roughly the ages of 14 to the ages of 17. At times, he would go above that age range. At times, he may go below that age range. But the vast majority of them are females. And these young men or older men who are coming out now and stating that Jimmy Seville sexually assaulted them, he molested them, my personal opinion, based on everything that I have read, they're publicity seekers. And I say this because some of the stuff that has been attributed to him have been found to be hoaxes. One of these hoaxes got so big that the British government actually looked into it, and the man who perpetrated the hoax was eventually found to be a career fraudster. And this hoax that came out concerned a dossier on Jimmy Seville and Cyril Smith being linked to a hotel in Rocks Lane in southwest London. This particular hotel was known as the Elms Guesthouse. And it came out after Seville was dead that he and a number of other prominent men, including MPs and British prime ministers, would go to this guest house with the specific intent of having sex and abusing underage boys. It was later found that there was no veracity to these claims, and that the individual who perpetrated this hoax, a man by the name of Chris Fay, as I stated, was a known career fraudster. And I believe, and this is my personal opinion, that the young men and older men who are coming forward stating that Jimmy Seville sexually abused them fall in the same category of them. I'm not stating that they weren't abused at some point in their life, but it is my belief after years and years of research on not just Jimmy Seville, but many, many other horrible individuals, that they are trying to get their name in print, possibly get some money from the British government and or from Seville's estate. Because, as I stated, historically, it is very, very unlikely that a predator is going to switch genders and also switch age ranges from them. So, to sum it up, my personal opinion is that Jimmy Seville did in fact target young women and girls, but that he never went after young boys. That's not to say he may not have done some awful things to young boys, but to think that this prolific sex offender, very possibly the most prolific in British history, was started out in the 1950s taking advantage of and abusing girls, and then once his star is, you know, shining brightly, all of the sudden he starts abusing young boys. Doesn't make any sense, and there is no concrete evidence to back that up, be it pictures of Seville, you know, with these young boys, or data from sex offenders to show that they, you know, he was going both ways. Jimmy Savile never, ever, privately or publicly, made mention of young boys. In fact, when he would talk about the allegations against him that he liked having sex with underage people, it always involved young girls. And as you're going to see, while we progress next week into the 1970s, which is really the period in time that the majority of the allegations come out against Jimmy Savile, even when the police investigated him, it was never an investigation of Jimmy Savile being involved in sex offenses against young boys. It's always in Jimmy Savile having done something to a young girl or to a group of young girls. With his favorite target being the Duncroft School, approved school for young girls. We are going to end this week on that note. I hope you have enjoyed the Deathcast for this week. Again, I am your host, best-selling author Ian Totten. If you enjoy this show, please like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever it is you get your podcasts, be that on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Podcast Addict, Stitcher. And please consider going to patreon.podbean.com/deathcast and becoming a patron for as little as $2 a month. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.